So tonight's reading is from Isaiah 42, verses 1 to 12, and you can find this on page 728. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law. Thus says God, the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison those who sit in darkness. I am the Lord. That is my name. My glory I give to no other, nor my praise to carved idols. Behold, the former things have come to pass, and new things I now declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. Sing to the Lord a new song, his praise from the end of the earth. You will go down to the sea and all that fills it, the coastlands and their inhabitants. Let the desert and its cities lift up their voice, the villages that Kedar inhabits. Let the inhabitants of Selah sing for joy. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the coastlands.
Thank you, Sabine. Please do keep that passage open and do turn to the outline. It's the white sheet inside your service sheet, headed Isaiah. Last year, there was a Welsh woman called Fran Murphy who was on holiday in France, and she was paddling in the sea with three friends, and she was walking on this sandbank that was off the beach, and suddenly this sandbank collapsed underneath them and there was nothing under their feet, and she wasn't a good swimmer and she panicked and couldn't get back to shore, and she was struggling to keep her head above water and she was losing consciousness when suddenly out of nowhere this mystery man appeared in the water and grabbed her and dragged her back to the shore. She said afterwards, "I don't remember anything about my Saviour, but my friends gave me a description. He told one of my friends that he was from Swansea. He joked that if he'd known that we were from Cardiff, he'd have left us in there." Thank you, Tara. And he just said, "Well, if you're okay, I'll go back to my holiday." And he disappeared. And she's now trying to trace this mystery man from Swansea to thank him for saving her life. Well, in the passage we just had read, Isaiah 42, 1 to 12, you've got this mystery rescuer who just suddenly appears on the scene in the book of Isaiah, and then just as suddenly disappears again. And he's referred to as the Lord's servant. And he reappears in another four passages, which have come to be known as the servant songs, though there's no evidence they were ever sung. And in them, God speaks about this servant, or he speaks to him, or even on occasion, the servant himself speaks. Now, why are these servant songs significant? They're significant because this servant is the key to everything. He's the key to everything. You see, in Isaiah, there is this huge gulf between present reality and future promise. So, for example, in the very beginning of Isaiah, in the first chapter, we've got this tale of two cities, as it's been called. That you've got the present reality of Jerusalem. It's a city of rebels and sinners. But then God promises that one day it's going to be this faithful city of righteousness. You know, lovely dream. But how on earth was that transformation going to come about? You know what it's like with politicians at election time. You know, they make all sorts of promises, pledges about the future. But so often it proves to be hot air. They can't deliver. Is this going to be any different? The answer is yes, it will be, because of this servant figure. He is the key to all God's promises for our world. He's the bridge, if you like, that spans this gulf between the present and the future God has promised. As 2 Corinthians 1:20 puts it, all the promises of God find their yes in him. So are you someone looking for answers to the big questions of life? If you long for personal change, would you love to know God? Or are you maybe feeling overwhelmed by sin and by failure? Are you perhaps disillusioned with the state of the world? The answer is not a program, but a person, this servant of the Lord. And in today's passage, God speaks about him in verses 1 to 4, and then he speaks to him in verses 5 to 7. So first question, who is he? The mystery rescuer of that Welsh holidaymaker was described as about 6 foot 4 inches tall, a good height to be, a strong swimmer, and calm in a crisis, and from Swansea. So that narrows it down. What about this mystery rescuer in Isaiah? Well, if you've got it open, Isaiah 42, verse 1, God says of him, "Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights, I have put my spirit upon him." So he's clearly someone very special. He's God's servant. He's upheld by God, so no power is going to be able to stop him. He's chosen by God for a particular mission. And God delights in him, and God has put his spirit on him. It's not a lot to go on yet, but the five servant songs, you get this sort of composite portrait emerging of what this servant will be like and how through him God will achieve his purposes for the world and for his people. So who is he? Our children love watching Top Gear. I don't know if you're into BBC's Top Gear series, and they know a lot more about cars than I do. One of the most popular figures on Top Gear is not actually Jeremy Clarkson, but the mystery man in the white suit, the Top Gear test driver in the white race overalls and helmet, whose identity is a closely guarded secret, and who is known simply as the Stig. The Stig. Finally, after 7 years, his identity was revealed as being the former racing driver Ben Collins. That was back in 2010. I think there's now a new mystery man behind the mask. Took a lot longer than 7 years for the identity of the servant to be revealed. In fact, it was more than 700 years before the writers of the New Testament Gospels proclaimed that he had finally come. So if you turn to Matthew 12 on page 985, and it'd be worth flicking this up. Matthew chapter 12, page 985, verse 15. Says that Jesus, aware of this, that is that the Pharisees were out to kill him, withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all, and ordered them not to make him known. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. "Behold my servant whom I have chosen," and on it goes, quoting our passage from today. Matthew, the former tax collector, he had left everything to follow this man Jesus. He was in no doubt at all that this man, Jesus, was the promised servant that Isaiah had foretold. And his certainty can be and should be ours today. You know how it works at passport control? That you get your passport and you hand it in. And the official basically sort of opens it up and looks down at it. So I brought an old one here with the chopped off bits because I know I'd lose it otherwise. But, you know, the official takes it off you and they sort of look down at this thing, look down at the photo. Then they look up at you and they sort of look you in the eyes. I don't know exactly what they're looking for, but they're clearly looking for something. They know what they're looking for and they scrutinize you to see if it's the same person. Well, the Old Testament is, if you like, the passport for this servant of the Lord. And when the New Testament writers look down at this passport, the Old Testament, and then they looked up at this person standing in front of them, Jesus, they knew that they had a match. It was the same person. So the Old Testament description of what this servant would be like and what he would do confirmed that this Jesus was the servant. How on earth would this one? I mean, this is one of Nelson. How do they get from the baby that, you know, when he's 5 years old? Anyway, you can tell me afterwards how they do it. Why did God reveal so much about this servant so many years before he came? In fact, it was centuries before he came. Well, I think there were two reasons. One reason is so that the people back then would have hope. And the second reason is that we today would have certainty. This match between Old Testament prophecy and New Testament history, it means that we can be absolutely certain about Jesus. That he's not a con, that we haven't been deceived, but that we are right to put all our eggs, if you like, in the Jesus basket, to put all our faith in him, all our hope in him. If you're someone who at the moment isn't convinced about Jesus, it is well worth investing a bit of time to look at the evidence for yourself. And the Christianity Explored course we run, starts October 1st, is a great way to do that. The identity of the Stig is interesting. The identity of the servant is life-changing. But what is clear to us now with hindsight would have been a mystery to God's people way back in the 8th century BC. So they would have been scratching their heads and trying to work out who on earth this servant figure is. But what would have been clear was who he wasn't. That is to say that this servant wasn't them. It wasn't them. Now you may think that's a fairly odd thing to say, but in Isaiah, God's people are actually referred to on occasion as being God's servant. In fact, either side of this first servant song, there are passages in which Israel, God's people, is referred to as God's servant. So if you turn back a page to chapter 41, verse 8. 41:8, God says, "But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen." And verse 9, "You are my servant, I have chosen you." But God's servant Israel was such a contrast to this figure in the servant songs. So just after the passage in 42 verse 19, God says of his people Israel, so of that servant, 42:19, "Who is blind but my servant, or deaf as the messenger I sent?" And in 22, that this people are trapped in holes and hidden in prisons. It's quite a contrast, isn't it? God's servant Israel was spiritually blind and deaf and captive and disobedient, whereas the servant in the servant songs, the ultimate servant of the Lord, he would open the eyes of the blind and he would free the captives and he was completely obedient to God. So they're very, very different. The point is this, that the servant, if we like, capital S of the servant songs, he was too ideal a figure to be Israel. In fact, he was everything that Israel should have been, but wasn't. He was God's answer to their weakness. He was God's answer to their failure. And he's ours as well. All of us by nature are as Israel were. We're spiritually blind and deaf and captive and disobedient. And we can't save ourselves. The point is our only hope is the servant of the Lord. And if we've accepted that, we need to keep on remembering it and reminding ourselves of this truth. Because sometimes we get so down about ourselves, don't we? Because of our failure, because of our sin. And we get disillusioned and we beat ourselves up because we're so weak and we mess up so much. But God knows that. And that is precisely why he sent the servant, capital S. Because of our failure as his servants, small s. This servant of the servant songs, he is the key to God's purposes in the world, and you are not. And he is the one who can sort out everyone's problems, you are not. Sometimes we can put enormous pressure on ourselves as servants of God, and we think, well, it's all up to me. As if, you know, the salvation of people I know, it all rests on my little shoulders. And I must sort out everyone else's problems, and everybody needs me, and the future of the church lies with me, and the success or failure of whatever little ministry I'm involved in, it's all down to me. We put enormous pressure on ourselves. Yes, we are to serve, but you are not, and I am not, the key to God's purposes in the world. Jesus is the servant. And what a relief that is. And so focus on him and look to him and trust in him and point other people to him and proclaim him. Secondly, what will he do? The focus of the servant's mission comes up three times in these verses. I don't know if you spotted it, but verse 1, he will bring forth justice to the nations. Verse 3, he will faithfully bring forth justice. And verse 4, till he has established justice in the earth. For us, justice is it's about the guilty being punished and the innocent being acquitted. But the Hebrew word here, translated justice, a word mishpat, it's much, much bigger than that. It's about right order being established. It's about God's purposes for the world being fulfilled. For example, it's what you see in the book of Judges. So, judge, justice, it's the same root word. In the book of Judges, what happens is, when God's people disobey God, they're beaten down by their oppressors, but then God sends a champion, and order is then restored so the people can enjoy the kind of life God intended for them. So justice is this good order of God, God's good order. Now, what's the opposite of that? Well, the opposite of God's good order is disorder and chaos. It's what you find back in the second verse of the Bible, Genesis 1:2, where it says the earth was without form and void. That Hebrew word tohu, it means emptiness, confusion, chaos. Now this is interesting, it comes up 19 times in the Old Testament. 11 of those are in the book of Isaiah. It's a big theme in Isaiah. And in Isaiah it's especially connected with idolatry. So the worship of false gods, it brings chaos, emptiness. The coming of the servant would bring in God's, establish God's good order over the whole world. Without the Christ, you've got confusion, you've got chaos, spiritually, morally, personally, nationally, globally, it's chaos. Whereas the coming of the servant brings God's good order. Yesterday we were out in Westfield and we needed to get some glasses for Sebastian, so our oldest, who needs to get some and who's going to get fitted out. And we had a bit of time to kill waiting to go and pick up the prescription from the opticians. And we went to a bookshop and I started flicking through a few books and came across a fascinating book about storytelling. And the introduction was saying, what do the following films have in common? Jaws, Jurassic Park, Godzilla, all the James Bond films, every episode of Spooks, Casualty, House or CSI, Fatal Attraction, Aaron Brockovich, The Towering Inferno, and The Poseidon Adventure. And the answer this guy gave was that it's the same underlying story. Quote, a dangerous monster threatens a community. One man takes it on himself to kill the beast and restore happiness to the kingdom. That's the basic story behind all those films. And that is the basic structure of the ultimate true story of the servant, and of which these other stories are echoes. Sin has brought chaos to the world. God sends his servant to kill the beast and establish his right order, restoring happiness to the kingdom. I know there are a bit of tweaks on that, but you know, as an underlying story, it's not a bad start. George W. Bush said on one occasion, it'll take time to restore chaos and order. Order out of chaos. Anyway, it's a good YouTube clip if you want to watch it. One of his many Bushisms. And so it will take time for God to restore order to his world. But through his servant Jesus, it's happening and it will be complete at his return. Now you see this in individual lives, don't you? In fact, wherever Jesus went during his earthly ministry, with a word or a touch, he brought order and wholeness to disordered, broken lives. Lovely example in Mark chapter 4, where there's that demon-possessed man who lived among the tombs, and he was often bound by chains, and he was naked and was harming himself with stones, and no one had the strength to subdue him. And then Jesus comes along. And with a word, he casts out the evil spirits. And when the local people come flocking to see what on earth was going on, what do they find? They find the man sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and begging Jesus to allow him to go with him. And Jesus does the same today. He brings order to the chaos of lives disordered by sin. And I love hearing people's stories of this, and we've had loads of them on the barge at special events. John Cartledge, this is some years back, don't know if you remember it, but the homeless alcoholic sitting around on park benches who came to Christ, hasn't touched a drop since, and is now running a Christian bookshop in Africa. Yvonne Edwards, enslaved to drink and drugs and ended up in despair, tried to take her own life, and came to Christ. And she's now here at the lunchtime talks every week, works in the wharf, living an ordered, purposeful life, serving the Lord. David Hamilton, former terrorist, his life full of hatred, full of violence, now through Christ, loving, gentle, self-controlled, and serving others as a church minister. And this good order that the servant brings to disordered lives, individual lives he touches, he brings to communities and he even brings to countries as they follow him. The atheist journalist Matthew Paris, he wrote a fascinating article in the Times some years ago that was titled, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God." And here's part of what he wrote. He said, now a confirmed atheist, I have become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa. Sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. It's an amazing thing for him to write, and he could see the effect of this wherever he went, in contrast to the disorder that came with traditional tribal religion. And he concluded the article in this way. He said, removing Christian evangelism from the African equation, it may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. This good order the servant brings is spreading like the warmth of spring after a long, cold winter. And when he returns, it will cover the whole world. I sometimes go to speak at assembly at the local primary school where our kids are. And the children often sing a song which goes, "Think of a world." I don't know if you know that kids' song where it's a song of thanksgiving which imagines what the world would be like without the good gifts God has given us. Think of a world without any flowers. Think of a world without any trees, without any sunshine, and so on. It's quite a moving little song. But imagine for a moment the opposite. Think of a world without any of the bad stuff. A world without violence, without wars, without people being beaten to death on Thai beaches. Think of a world without broken families and poverty and disease. Well, the servant will establish justice in the earth. Through the servant, order will be restored and people are rescued. So verse 6 says, "I give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness." In his ministry, how many blind people did Jesus heal? Well, certainly a few. How many people did he get out of prison? Not a single one. Not a single one. And in fact, since then, countless people have ended up in prison precisely for following him. But this is obviously talking about a spiritual reality. The Persian king Cyrus, he would rescue God's people from physical captivity in Babylon, but the servant of the Lord would rescue them from spiritual captivity and spiritual blindness. The Bible says the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. So people are born spiritually blind. They're born in the dark. But Jesus, the servant, has come as a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind. The Bible says that everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. And it says that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. But Jesus the servant has come to set the prisoner free. He's delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. Again, some of Matthew Paris's observations in Africa are very striking. He wrote this, he said, "In the city we had working for us Africans who had converted and who were strong believers. The Christians were always different. Far from having cowed or confined its converts, their faith appeared to have liberated and relaxed them. There was a liveliness, a curiosity, an engagement with the world, a directness in their dealings with others that seemed to be missing in traditional African life. They stood tall." He went on to say that whenever we entered a territory worked by missionaries, we had to acknowledge that something changed in the faces of the people we passed and spoke to. Something in their eyes. The way they approached you was direct and man-to-man without looking down or away. They hadn't become more deferential towards strangers, in some ways less so, but more open. In the circles in which many of us move, people are very good, aren't they, at giving the impression that everything is okay and life is fine, it's all sorted. We need to remember the Bible's diagnosis: spiritually blind, spiritually captive, and needing rescue. And that is the business the servant is in. What is the most loving thing you can do for a person? Introduce them to the servant, because he alone can open their eyes and he alone can set them free. But final question is, how will he do it? So how will he establish God's order throughout the world? How will he defeat the monster and rescue people from the tyranny of sin and evil? Well, actually, in a very unusual way. And the other servant songs will tell us more, but for now, notice there are three things it says here that he won't do. Firstly, verse 2. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. It's not saying he won't talk, but it says he won't cry aloud, as in sort of startling people. And he wouldn't lift up his voice in the sense of trying to dominate other people and shout them down and pressurize them. And he wouldn't make his voice heard in the streets in the sense of advertising himself with glamour and show and sort of making a big noise about himself. He wouldn't do that. At his baptism that we were thinking about at the beginning of our service, marking the beginning of his public ministry, the Holy Spirit came down on Jesus in the form of a dove, a symbol of gentleness. It didn't come down on him in the form of a lion or a grizzly bear or something. And that is how he went about his ministry, gently. Teaching, loving, healing the sick, serving, withdrawing from the crowds, as we saw in the Matthew passage, not drawing attention to himself, and in the end, laying down his life for us. And that is how he continues to work in the world today, through his people, as they live changed lives, and as they share the good news of the kingdom. The way of the servant is not the way of the world. So some people in the world, they try to bring about change through going on the campaign trail and aggressively marketing and shouting down their opponents, maybe promoting their cause with show and glitz and glamour and getting as much money behind the thing as possible, like a US presidential campaign. But that is not the way of the servant. Others try to impose change through force, through power, a noisy revolution, subduing all before them through violence and terror. Such was the way of the ancient kings, people like Cyrus, before whom the ends of the earth trembled, Isaiah 41:5 says. Such was the way of the zealots at the time of Jesus. So the zealots were a Jewish nationalist party. They tried to overthrow Roman rule by violence. So in 66 AD, they massacred the Roman garrison in Jerusalem. And they brought down on themselves the wrath of Rome and the destruction of the city by the Roman armies 4 years later under Titus. Such also was the way of Muhammad. As somebody wrote recently, Jesus arrived in Jerusalem on a donkey to be executed a week later for our sins. Muhammad arrived at Mecca in front of an army of 10,000 soldiers to take the city by force. The servant will conquer the world, but not in the world's way. Quiet revolution of love and service and sharing the good news with gentleness and respect. I love the story of Justin Martyr. I don't know if you come across him, but he was a guy who lived in the second century. And he had been born a pagan, and he traveled the world looking for truth, looking for answers, didn't find them. And then one day, walking near the shore at Ephesus, he met an old man of meek and venerable manners who pointed him to the scriptures and to Jesus Christ. And he became a Christian. He went on to become one of the greatest of the early apologists who defended the Christian faith in their writings. Very striking, just the gentle witness of word and life of this old guy on the beach at Ephesus. So the servant won't cry aloud, and the second thing he won't do is he won't break a bruised reed. So verse 3 says, a bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. There was a 17th century preacher called Richard Sibbes, who for a while was based over at Gray's Inn, and he wrote a whole book on this one verse called The Bruised Reed and the Smoking Flax. Those were the days. And became a classic. And both of these images are pictures of people who feel weak and broken. They're pictures of people who feel they're aware of their failure, aware of their sin and their need. So they're like this fragile reed or straw which is bent and it can't support any weight. Or they're like a candle which is spluttering and flickering and in danger of going out. And that is how God's people would have felt back then in the time of Isaiah. And it's how many of us may feel today. But the servant comes as the healer of broken lives. He's gentle, he's patient, he bears with us in our weakness. Perhaps today you're feeling weak, you're feeling useless. Maybe you're feeling down on yourself and you think, well, I've got little to offer. Maybe you're feeling guilty, burdened by sin. The bruised reed, the faintly burning wick, you think, well, that's me. That's how I feel. And maybe if you're feeling like that, you fear, well, you know, God's finally probably had enough and he's just going to snap me in two and throw me in the bin. Or he's just going to snuff out the flickering flame. As if, well, you know, he's only got time for the strong. That is not how the servant operates. So come to him. Come to him. And like him, we should be gentle in dealing with one another. So 1 Thessalonians 5:14 says, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, and be patient with everyone. The third thing the servant won't do is in verse 4. It says he won't grow faint or be discouraged until he has established justice in the earth. It doesn't really come across in the English translation here, but the terms mirror the terms in verse 3. So it's saying that the servant himself, he's not a bruised reed and he isn't a faintly burning wick. He will see his mission through. He will succeed. The other servant songs will reveal that the servant will go on to suffer and suffer terribly, but he won't be deterred by his suffering. He'll see it through to the end. He will succeed. And that will happen because verses 5 and 6 say that it's the Creator God who's going to keep him. He's chosen, he's called, he's empowered by God, and so nothing is going to stop the servant completing his mission. Well, it's just as well, isn't it? It's just as well that he won't grow faint or discouraged because we often do, don't we? We often feel faint and discouraged. And if it was up to us, it'd be completely hopeless. In Christian service, all of us will go through times when we feel weary, we feel discouraged. Perhaps in our witness to others, or maybe in our service, at church, at home. And we feel like, you know, nothing much is happening here. But this mission is his mission. And the key to God's purposes is him, not me. And so look to him. Well, as we close, how should we respond to this servant song? Verse 10 says, Sing to the Lord a new song, his praise from the ends of the earth. It's what you find after each of the five servant songs. There's a call to praise. Praise the Lord for his servant. Thank God for Jesus. That woman, Fran Murphy, she said about her mystery rescuer, "I just want to say thank you. He did an amazing thing." Well, that's a natural response, isn't it? And so we should give thanks to the servant for his amazing work. And we should give praise to God for him. And that should be the theme tune of our songs and of our lives. So firstly, praise for him. Secondly, we should look to him. How does this servant enter the stage? Well, in verse 1, with God saying, "Behold my servant." And what does behold mean? It means to look. God's basically saying, he's drawing attention to him. He's saying, look, look at him, my servant. And so that is what we need to do. You ever tempted to despair about the state of the world? You know, you read the latest reports about the advance of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and you wonder, you know, what sort of world are my children going to grow up in 30 years' time, or whatever. It's pretty scary, isn't it? You know, a terror group like that controlling oil fields that have a daily output worth $1.2 million on the underground market. It's a lot of money for a terror group to have coming in each day. The world looked very, very bleak to the people in Isaiah's day. What was God's answer? Behold my servant. Look to him. He will establish God's good order in the whole world, and nothing can stop that happening. Or do you ever feel God has forgotten you? Do you ever feel like that? Maybe circumstances getting you down, things not working out as you want. You feel, well, God's forgotten me. God's people felt like that. Isaiah 49:14. But Zion said, that's God's people, Zion said, "The Lord has forsaken me. The Lord has forgotten me." What was God's answer? Behold my servant. Look to Jesus. If God didn't spare his own son but gave him up for you, he's hardly going to forget you, is he? Or do you ever feel a failure because of sin? Do you maybe look around at church and think of yourself as being a second-class citizen compared to all the other keen beans who've got everything sorted? I met up this past week with a Christian friend who doesn't come to Sunday church here. He told me that about how her mother had pushed her to achieve when she was young. So from her earliest days, her own mother had grown up in poverty and didn't have anything at all. And she'd sort of grown up saying, "I don't want that for my children." So she pushed her children really hard to achieve. And the only question my friend was ever asked when she came home from school was, "What grades did you get today?" Not, you know, "How was your day? How things been?" "What grades did you get today?" It's all that mattered. And my friend was telling me that she now feels the same pressure from God, as if God is always pushing her to achieve and to do more, and she feels that she never makes the grade. And she said whenever she hears a Bible talk, she feels condemned. And she always feels, look, the bar is just too high for me and I can't get there. I've never seen anyone get through so many Kleenex in one session. What is the answer? Well, surely a big part of it is, behold my servant. Look to Jesus. It's not about us achieving. It's not about us making the grade. It's not about us being God's perfect servants, because we aren't. It's about this servant of the Lord and what he has done and what he is doing and what he will do. And as we come to him in our sin and weakness and brokenness, we find that a bruised reed he will not break. We're going to take a minute or two now just to pause and reflect and to pray. And then when the music starts, we're going to stand and sing a couple of songs which are all about the servant, behold the servant, the light of the world who stepped down into the darkness of this world. And they encourage us to look to him.